arms and had drawn their short, straight swords. He turned back to the master and bared his teeth. "Don't," Ferris said, his voice softening. "Please don't. There's too much pain on that path." The two men on the floor gained their feet. The third man took a deep breath.
"Folly,"
the master said.
"Close your eyes."
Folly did, at once. There was a guttural shout from the intruder. There was a volley of hissing sounds and a chorus of shrieks, then screams, and silence. And the smell of burning meat. Folly swallowed and rose slowly. She cracked open one eye, and then the other. The master hadn't said she had to keep her eyes closed indefinitely. He was unharmed. He stood in the same spot, his head bowed, the crystal of his cane now dark again, resting against the floor as though the implement had grown too heavy for him to hold. Folly did not look at what was left of the intruders in their disguises. It was disturbing, and she was at the limits of her skills as a spider already. She needed no further bad dreams. She carefully did not let herself cry, though she wanted to very much. It pained the master to see her cry, and she would rather be burned to death herself than to give him pain. He'd have so much of it already. She reached his side and touched his arm gently.
"Are you all right, teacher?"
She watched his hollow, weary eyes stare for long heartbeats at the scorched knot-men who now littered their library floor before he answered.
"What have we learned today, Folly?"
"That one ought not to use etheric weapons against an etherealist."
"Well, what you say is very true.
I was hoping for a different context."
"Ah," Folly said. She considered for a moment and said,
"Someone sent these men here to kill you specifically."
"Good. Continue."
"They had to know where you lived. Therefore, someone who knows you, or knows of you, is responsible for them."
"Correct,"
the master said. He lowered his voice to a preoccupied mumble.
"I confess I did not catch the faintest glimpse of this future."
Folly frowned suddenly, wrinkling her nose. She knew she could not actually smell it, but her mind told her that she could feel the stench filling her nose. Fear hovered around Ephyrus Ephrenus Ferris, Master Etherealist.
"You know,"
Folly said.
"You know who sent them."
"I think so."
"Who is it, teacher?"
"An old friend."
"A friend who has been dead for a decade."
Folly considered the words for a moment before saying carefully,
"That does not seem probable."
"Oh, aye,"
the master said.
"It's utterly mad. But there it is."
"Teacher, I don't understand."
"There's no rush,"
he said in a very soft voice.
"You will, soon enough."
Folly bowed her head a little.
"Teacher?"
"Yes?"
"What shall we do now?"
"Fetch my dueling suit, if you would," he said. "Also, 3 feathers and a tack hammer. Ready my collection. Oh, and pack a bag."
"A bag?"
"A bag with food, clothing, books, that sort of thing. We'll be leaving the Havel."
Folly blinked several times.
"What? We will? To go where?"
"First, we'll go to see the Spirarch and get him to give us the Grim Captain," he said.
"And then?"
Something dark and hard rose for a moment in the master's eyes, and the look made Folly shiver.
"And then,"
he said quietly,
"we shall visit an old friend."
Chapter 18. Spire Albion, Havel Morning, Spire Ark's Manor. 12 hours after the fighting ended, Grim wanted nothing so much as a bath and his bunk on Predator. He ached for them, in fact. When he was this weary, his sleep would be too deep to be disturbed by dreams of the men he had lost in the fighting. He could put off, for at least one night, being haunted by the faces and limbs that had been crushed, scorched and mangled by the first battle of what could be a long and costly war. Instead of resting, though, he and Creedy followed a slim, aging, gentlemanly sort of fellow named Vincent from the entry hall of the Spireark's Manor down a hallway with polished wooden walls and floors, decorated with some of the finest art in Spire Albion. According to the engraved brass plaques beside each piece, there were paintings from the giddy days of the New Dawn, 2 centuries before, sculptures from the Olympian master MacDaggett, and other pieces, some of them attributed to relatively unknown artists currently working in Spire Albion. They were exquisite, Grimm thought. He approved of the taste of whoever had decorated the hall. They were shown into what appeared to be a study, also furnished entirely in wood, and lit with candles rather than lumen crystals. There was a large desk with 5 chairs set neatly in front of it. Vincent nodded to the chairs and said,
"If you will wait here, sirs, he will be with you shortly."
"Of course," Grimm said. He and Creedy sat while Vincent departed. It was perhaps a matter of 2 or 3 minutes before a door in the rear wall of the study opened and the Spireark came into the room. He was a man of no impressive height, and what might charitably be called a scholarly build. But Lord Albion's eyes were sharp and hard, and he moved with a brisk, no-nonsense sort of energy as he approached them. Grimm and Creedy rose at once to meet him. Albion came around the desk to offer his hand to Grimm.
"Captain Grimm," he said, "I hear extraordinary things about your service to the Spire in the face of the surprise attack."
"Sire," Grimm said, bowing his head slightly, "this is my XO, Byron Creedy." Creedy mumbled something Grimm couldn't understand and shook the Spireark's hand with a kind of numb shock on his features.
"Well," Albion said, "I know how tired you both must be, so sit, sit, and I'll be as succinct as possible."
They sat, while Lord Albion rested a hip against the edge of his desk, looking down at them with calm assessment clear in his eyes.
"I'm afraid you made a serious mistake today."
"Sire," Grimm said,
"you proved yourself extraordinarily capable, Captain,"
Albion said.
"I can hardly let something like that go unremarked."
"I don't understand, sir," Grimm said, frowning.
"Captain, your clarity of thought in the face of unexpected disaster is a rare quality. It's a poor reward for such heroism, but I'm afraid that I must insist upon continuing to use you for the good of my spire."
Grimm was quiet for a moment. He wanted to sink into a tub of hot water and soak away the violence and fear of hours of skirmishes with the Roran Marines. He wanted to sleep. Hadn't his men given enough?
"Sire," he said in a measured, quiet voice, "I have already offered such skills as I have in the service of Albion. The Spire made it quite clear to me that I was not needed."
"The Perilous incident, yes," Albion said. "I'm familiar with what happened. Or perhaps I should say, I'm familiar with both the history of what happened and with what actually transpired. You didn't have to accept your discharge quietly, Captain, but you did."
"It was what was best for the fleet, sire," Grimm said.
"An arguable point, I think," Lord Albion said. "But your sacrifice was, without doubt, a good thing for the fleet, if not for you personally."
"I didn't join the fleet to serve myself, sire," Grimm said.
"The best never do."
Albion gave Grimm a faint smile.
"But your previous difficulties are irrelevant, Captain. The Spire Council is, as we speak, voting to declare a state of war with Spire Aurora. The Spire needs every capable commander it can get."
"I hardly think the fleet will welcome me back in any capacity, sire," Grimm said in a voice that came out diamond hard, though he hadn't meant it to. "No one wants to work with a proven coward."
"I do,"
Albion said.
I'm not talking about returning you to the fleet, Captain.
I want you for myself.
Grim blinked. Sire, what I did today was what any competent professional commander would have done in my place. It does not qualify me for a position in your personal service.
Perhaps, Captain, judgments about what qualifies a given individual for the Spyrarch's service might best be made by the Spyrarch?
Lord Albion suggested, his eyes sparkling with quiet humour. Grim shifted in his chair uncomfortably.
Sire, I'm no diplomat, so with your leave I'll just say it and beg your pardon ahead of time if this comes out sounding unpleasant or disrespectful.
Creedy's eyes widened slightly, but he stayed as silent as a stone. Albion arched a brow.
Oh, by all means, Captain, speak.
I don't like it here. Spending more than a few weeks in this dreary old mausoleum makes me feel as if I can't breathe. I don't understand how any of you can stand it day in and day out. I'm an aeronaut, sire, living on a deck since I ever could remember. I belong in the sky. I belong on my ship. It's the only place that feels right.
Thank you for your offer, but I don't want another job.
I understand, Lord Albion said. But you proceed from a false assumption.
I don't want your service as an advisor on my staff, Captain.
He folded his arms and narrowed his eyes slightly. I want an airship helmed by a captain I can trust.
Grim and Creedy traded a surprised look.
Sire, I have need of a ship to serve as transport and support for a mission for my guard, Albion said. I've decided that I want Predator, along with her captain and crew, to fill that position.
What if they don't want to do it? Grim asked. Creedy made a choking sound.
I can be a very persuasive person, the Spyrarch said.
You have no legal authority to do that, Grim said.
You're right, but I mean to see it done all the same.
Perhaps it was the fatigue, but Grim found himself growing genuinely angry. Sire, he said stiffly, Predator is not for sale.
I am not for sale.
That brought a wolfish flash of a smile from Lord Albion. He pointed a forefinger at Grim and leaned forward slightly.
Exactly, Captain, exactly.
You've served Albion as a privateer for 18 months now.
This would be no different.
That's very generous, sire, Grim said cautiously.
Perhaps, though, you have not been made aware of Predator's state of repair. She's in need of refitting. It may be some time before she's skyworthy.
Decades, perhaps, Grim thought.
She's running on nothing but her trim crystals.
I'm not an aeronaut, Captain, the Spyrarch said apologetically.
Or an aeronautical engineer. What does that mean, precisely?
She can only go up and down, Creedy said in a helpful tone, and she has to do it very slowly.
Ah, Albion said, brightening. As it happens, that is precisely what I need your ship to do.
Grim narrowed his eyes.
Meaning what, exactly?
I'm sending a team to landing, the Spyrarch replied. It needs to be done quickly, before dawn, if possible. I'm sure that your ship is adequate to...
Grim rose, his heart pounding harder and louder as his anger grew.
Sire! He all but snapped. With all due respect, there is ample transport to landing. Send them down in a barge or a windlass.
Lord Albion's head drew back slightly, his eyebrows lifted in surprise.
Captain, I am not sure why the idea upsets you so.
My ship isn't a barge, and she's bloody well no windlass, Grim snarled. And while I'm alive, she never will be. Not for the fleet, not for the bloody Spire Council, and not for you, sire. Thank you for the offer, but I cannot help you. If you will excuse me, please, I must see to the needs of my wounded and dead. Creedy.
Grim turned to leave, and Creedy lurched up out of his chair to follow, his face pale. Albion sighed audibly. Just as Grim reached for the door, he said,
"That's a shame, Captain. I wish we could have worked something out. Do you perhaps know someone in the market for new lift-and-trim crystals for a ship Predator size? It seems I'll have some spares on my hands."
Grim froze with his hand on the doorknob. He tilted his head and then turned slowly, inexorably, back toward the Spyrarch. Albion gave him a feline smile.
"Do this work for me, and you'll be making the trip down to landing with top-of-the-line replacements from the Lancaster Vattery. I'm told your engineer can have them installed and calibrated within a week."
"You would do that?" Grim breathed. "In exchange for what?"
"This job,"
Albion said.
"One job. Take my team to landing. Provide whatever support you can for them while they are there. Bring them back here when they're done."
"One job," Grim said.
"Frankly, Captain, my hope is that you will see the advantages of my offer and be inclined to work with me on an ongoing basis. But if you want nothing to do with me after this, so be it. Keep the crystals and go your way."
"If I did, you'd be throwing away a fortune." Lord Albion shrugged.
"I prefer to think of it as an investment in the future, Captain Grim. What say you?"
Grim exhaled through his nose. The anger was still burning, but smouldering alongside it was hope. Unattainably valuable replacements for Predator's damaged crystals, waiting to be installed. His ship rising above the mists again to sail in the blinding light of the sun, his crew's livelihood secured, and yet Predator would be bound to no one but her captain.
Freedom.
Grim realized with a sudden shock of purely mental impact that nothing on earth could convince him to turn down such a deal.
"I say," Grim began slowly. Then he sighed. "I say that you are a manipulative son of a bitch, sire."
"Each and every day of the week," Lord Albion replied, nodding.
He met Grim's eyes.
"And I don't turn my back on my people, Captain."
He hadn't said, "the way that Fleet does," but it hung unspoken in the silence after his words. Albion lifted his hands, palms out, as if signalling the end of a bout, and regarded Grim with a frank gaze.
"It's as simple as this. I need you, Captain. The Spire needs you."
Grim clenched his right hand into a fist for a moment, and then relaxed.
"Mr. Creedy."
"Captain?"
"Return to Predator. Inform Engineer Journeyman that he has work to do. Make ready to sail to landing."
Chapter 19. Spire Albion, Havel Landing. Major Ronaldo Espira, Auroran Marine, walked calmly through the cramped, crowded streets of Havel Landing, dressed in local clothing, carrying a crate marked with the logo of one of Landing's water farms. Though there was much excitement and the buzz of talk and rumour in the Havel, evidently the authorities of Havel Landing had not yet realized the extent of his battalion's incursion into Spire Albion, and no checkpoints or patrols had yet been established. He could still move about in relative freedom. The initial assault had come off with as much success as any combat mission could reasonably expect. He had yet to hear from the assault teams striking Havel morning, but his marines' months of training in the precision maneuver of parasails had paid off handsomely. Already, better than 400 of the 500 men under his command had made contact and begun to concentrate, and there had been reports of fewer than 20 men who had failed to target one of the Spire's many ventilation ports properly. It looked as though, barring bad luck, he would have more than enough men to attain his objectives, and if he was able to see the most daring raid in the history of any Spire to completion, his fortunes in Spire Aurora would be secured for life. Espira wove his way through the hectic streets of Landing. Most habbles in every spire had modified the original spaces as designed by the builders, adding in fortifications, additional housing, more batteries, whatever was needed. But the inhabitants of Landing had done so to an extent that was little better than madness. They had actually divided their habbles' vertical space in half, in effect creating two duplicate levels of the same habble, one stacked atop the other. It meant that the normally spacious ceilings of a basic habble had been turned into close, looming things, and they made Espira feel as if the ceiling were slowly coming down on top of him. If that madness was not enough, they had then filled both of those spaces to overflowing with more masonry and wooden construction than Espira had ever seen. The streets had turned from broad walkways into cramped, narrow affairs, where no more than three men could have walked beside one another. Houses and businesses were pressed together wall to wall, and the doorways were by necessity narrow ones. One literally could not walk 20 steps on the streets of Landing without brushing body to body with a fellow pedestrian. This wasn't a habble. It was a warren for rats. And yet, there were expensive wooden doors on nearly every home. In places, entire homes had been constructed of wood, and they did not look particularly lavish either, being built with a sturdy, bland functionality that suggested the residences of craftsmen and tradesmen. Yet the amount of wood that went into building a single such residence would have sold for enough money to keep a man in food and drink for a lifetime. Rats indeed, greedy, gnawing, thieving rats. Let them flaunt their wealth. Things would change. He stalked through the narrow streets and wound his way down an alley between two buildings to an old, rotting wooden door. He paused to knock at it, three measured strokes followed by two quick ones, and it opened at once. Her Batman, Sark, stood on the other side of it. The fellow reminded Espira of a hunting spider. He was warrior-born, tall, gaunt, with long, slender limbs and hands that seemed a little too large for the rest of him. His hair was black and short and covered his face, head, neck, and what showed of his hands in a sparse, spidery fuzz. Sark had the feline eyes of his kind. One of them set at a slight angle to the other, so that Espira could never be sure precisely where the man was looking.
"What?"
Sark asked. His tone suggested that he would rather have killed Espira than spoken to him. Espira had not become the youngest major in the history of the Auroran Marine Corps by allowing himself to be intimidated by hard men.
"Is she here?" Espira asked Sark.
"Why?"
"There's a problem."
Sark looked at, or slightly past, Espira, and made a growling sound. Espira lifted his chin and narrowed his eyes.
"This is above your pay grade, Sark. Unless you'd prefer to explain to her why you turned away the man who came with a warning of the threat to her plan."
Sark didn't move for a moment, as still as any spider who senses that prey is coming near. Then he made a throaty sound and stepped back from the door, leaving it open. Espira walked in boldly and pressed his crate of vegetables into Sark's hands as though the man were a common servant. Sark accepted the burden, but his crooked eyes narrowed. Espira could feel them crawling over his back as he walked past the Batman and down the gloomy hallway to the copper-clad steel door to her chamber. He knocked and waited rather than entering. He was bold, not suicidal. After a moment, a woman's voice said,
"Come in, Major."
Espira opened the door, which moved easily and soundlessly on its hinges, and entered the room beyond. It was a luxurious chamber, a sitting room by design. Lumen crystals glowed in wall sconces. A large sculpture of Spire Albion resided in one corner of the room, with walking space all around it. Opposite the spire was the graceful shape of a large harp, nearly 5 feet high. a trickling fountain that had been carved into one wall made quiet, whispering sounds, and the water fell into a small pool filled with floating flowers and small, slithering forms that could only barely be glimpsed beneath its surface. She sat in one of two chairs near the pool, with a serving table placed between them. She was preparing two cups of tea, her motions calm and precise, somehow ritualistic. She wore a dark blue conservative gown, well-fitting, elegant and expensive. She was neither young nor old. Her lean, predatory features were intriguing, and something in the reserve of her movements whispered that a searing sensuality might lurk beneath a perfectly composed surface. It was her eyes that made Espira uneasy. They were the cold, flat grey of the mists that covered the world, and she rarely blinked. Espira made her a proper and polite bow. She remained still for a moment and then nodded to the second chair. Espira approached and sat.
"I pray you will forgive this intrusion, Madame Cavendish, but it was necessary to speak to you."
Instead of answering, she passed him a cup of tea on a fine ceramic saucer. He accepted it, of course, with a smile, and bowed his head in thanks. Madame Sycorax Cavendish was a very proper woman. Anyone who behaved toward her in any other fashion, so far as Espira could tell, did not survive the experience. So he smiled, waited until she had taken up her own cup, and sipped tea together with her. The tea, he noted, was his favourite. Olympian mint, and braced with the perfect amount of honey. Obviously his visit had not taken her by surprise. She'd had no way to know he was coming, yet, damn it, she'd known anyway. Her flat eyes watched him steadily over the rim of her teacup. He suppressed a shudder.
"Rinaldo,"
she said. Her voice was extraordinary, mellow, warm, and soft. The kind of voice that could give rest to weary convalescents, or gently lure an aeronaut to his doom on the surface.
"You know I enjoy your visits. Is there something I can do for you?"
She would not be pleased by his news, but there was no helping that.
"Our command post has been discovered."
Her cold eyes narrowed ever so slightly.
"Oh?"
"A verminositor stumbled across it in the pursuit of his duties, I'm afraid,"
Espira said, keeping his tone neutral, simply reporting objective facts.
"He was captured before he could escape and warn anyone of our presence."
Madame Cavendish arched an eyebrow.
"Captured?"
Espira pressed his lips together for a second, then nodded.
"The Verminositor's Guild of Landing requires them to work in pairs. He claims that he was working alone, that he didn't want to split the contract with one of his fellows."
"And he volunteered this information?"
"His story didn't change, even after vigorous inquisition," Espira said. "But we are too close to our goals to allow some small mischance to undermine us now. We need to be sure."
"I see,"
she said. She took another small sip of tea, her expression thoughtful.
"You would like me to determine his veracity?"
"In essence," Espira said. "Better safe than sorry."
"One might say,"
she murmured, her voice silken,
"that more foresight would have prevented this unfortunate event from coming to pass."
He'd seen men die just after the woman used that particular tone of voice. Espira took a moment to consider his reply carefully.
"One might also say that the view behind us is always clearer than that before. There are always unforeseen problems. The most vital skill a commander can possess is to recognize them when they appear and adapt to overcome them."
Madame Cavendish tilted her head, as if considering that statement.
I suppose that is a practical mindset for a military man,
she allowed.
Thus, you have sought out the support of an ally to adapt to this adversity.
Indeed, madame, he said. You know how highly I regard your judgment and your skills. The barest hint of a smile haunted one corner of her mouth.
Major, I know precisely what you think of me.
She resettled her fingers on her teacup and nodded slightly.
Very well. I will assist you.
You are most gracious, madame, Espira said, rising. Time is of the essence, so... Madame Cavendish's voice came out in two pulses of dulcet music, and the lumen crystals in the walls flickered a sullen scarlet in time with them.
Sit down!
Espira's heart abruptly leapt into his throat, a thrill of something like distilled panic flashing through his belly. He arrested his momentum and clumsily, quickly, took his seat again. Madame Cavendish's mouth widened into a smile, and she said, as if explaining to a child,
"We're still having tea."
Espira's mouth felt very dry. "Of course, madame. I pray you, please excuse my enthusiasm."
"I should think most successful soldiers bear the same burden," she replied, still smiling. They sipped together for a few more minutes, the silence deafening. Then Madame Cavendish put down her cup and saucer and said, "I trust you have arrangements in place to dispose of the remains once I'm finished."
"I do."
"Wonderful,"
she said. She picked up a matching serving plate, artfully arranged with a number of foods appropriate to the setting, and offered it to him with a smile.
"Do have a scone, Major. I made them myself."
Chapter 20. Spire Albion, Habel Morning, Spire Arks Manor. Gwendolyn Lancaster took the lead as they followed the Spire Arks batman deeper into the manor. Barely half a day had passed since the Auroran attack, but a good many things had changed, not the least of which was that she and Bridget, along with the rest of the recruits, had exchanged their training uniforms for the functional livery of the Spire Arks guard. A simple white shirt with dark blue trousers and jacket, the arms and legs seamed with gold piping.
"I cannot but think that this seems ill-advised," Bridget said from behind her. "A war has begun. Have we therefore somehow mystically acquired the knowledge we need to serve in the guard?"
"I should say it is a practical act, Bridget,"
Gwen replied.
"We have, after all, already faced the enemy and triumphed."
Bridget sounded doubtful.
"Triumph seems an awfully evocative word when compared to what actually happened. We met the enemy with deadly force, foiled their designs, and survived,"
Gwen said.
"And were rescued by those aeronauts." "We were most certainly not rescued,"
Gwen said.
"Not by aeronauts, and most specifically not by a man who was cast out of the fleet for cowardice."
"This should be interesting," Benedict said. "What did happen then, dear coz?"
Gwen sniffed. "My plan embraced the necessity of cooperation to overcome greater numbers. We kept the enemy pinned in place until the proper amount of force could be brought to bear against them. We were the anvil to the hammer of our reinforcements."
"Is she serious?"
Bridget asked Benedict.
"Sweet Gwen lives in a very special world," Benedict replied soberly, even kindly.
"Apparently it looks only somewhat like the place in which we mere mortals reside." Gwen turned and gave her cousin a narrow-eyed glare.
"In function, which part of my description is inaccurate?"
At that, the tall young man frowned. After a moment he shrugged and said, The part where you make it sound like that was your plan all along, instead of something you desperately improvised on the spur of the moment.
Of course I improvised it on the spur of the moment,
Gwen snapped.
They ambushed us.
But, Bridget said,
Gwen, the fight started when you discharged your gauntlet into that officer's face.
It is hardly my fault if they did not ambush us more effectively than they did,
Gwen replied. And if they had, or if I had not done what I did, none of us would be here right now.
She walked a few more steps before saying, And in any case, we did keep our heads in the midst of a great panic, and we saved poor Barney's life, which is what trained members of the guard are supposed to do, I believe.
That is certainly true, Benedict said with a note of approval in his voice. I should say as well, cuz, that I've never seen you flinch in the face of adversity. But one can never tell how a given person will react to real combat. You more than lived up to my expectations. Nerves of steel.
Thank you, cuz,
Gwen said, in a more subdued voice.
She didn't turn to look back again. The flash of her gauntlet's discharge kept playing back through her thoughts. The Auroran officer had been taken completely unaware by her sudden blast. There had been a slightly confused expression on his face, as if he hadn't quite heard the last phrase she'd said, and wished her to repeat it. She hadn't realized until much later how young the man had been. In the panic and concern for Barney, in the dust and the blood, she had seen a man in a uniform. But in her mind's eye, she had gradually discerned that he had been little older than she was, and certainly no older than Benedict. A young officer, perhaps one of the elite new crop of the Auroran Marine Corps, chosen to lead a small team on a straightforward but important support mission, bringing explosives to an assault team at a critical target. In the eyes of the men who planned the attack, it must have seemed an ideal assignment for a bright young prospect. Simple, unlikely to lead to direct combat in which an officer with an agile mind would be far more valuable than one experienced in battle, especially if he had the watchful eye of an experienced non-commissioned officer like Siriaco to guide him. Surely to some commander it seemed a fine mission to set a new rising star upon his ascendancy. And Gwendolyn had wiped the life from him as swiftly and as surely as the darkness swallowed shooting stars in the night. She wanted to feel remorse over it, to regret what she had done. It seemed to her that it was the sort of thing a decent person should feel. But when she sought for such emotions within herself, she mainly discovered a profound relief that she and her companions were still alive. But she couldn't stop thinking about his face. The blast had left a ruined mass where his face had been. She'd had to shoot him there, of course. There'd been no way of knowing whether he wore ether silk beneath his false uniform. She kept seeing his face in that brief, fatal flash, kept putting words into his mouth that had matched his expression. "Beg pardon, miss. Could you repeat that, please? What on earth are you doing?" Whatever would she have said in reply?
"Why, making a corpse from someone's beloved child, sir."
She hadn't eaten since. Lord Albion's batman reached the end of the richly appointed hallway and knocked on the door. At a word from beyond the door, he opened it for Gwen and her friends and bowed slightly, waving them in. Gwen swept into a room that was decorated and arranged like a small private study, but which was, in fact, something much more. Oh, certainly the desk and the lights, both lumen crystal and candles, were studious enough, as were the bookshelves, packed thick with many more volumes than they had been designed to hold. It was the subject matter of some of the titles that made it seem otherwise. The histories of Albion, written by Daggett and Dean, were common enough, but the set by Montclair that had been outlawed 2 centuries before, due to the scandalous rumours they had spread about the first Spirarch of Albion, were another matter. One rather thick volume was titled Means of Execution Through the Ages, and was placed with an elegant balance of nonchalance and availability at the eye level of anyone entering the room. As threats went, it was nearly subliminal.
and perhaps it was placed there for that very reason. Behind the desk, in a case, were miniature replicas of each and every airship in the Ethereum fleet of Albion. From the mighty battleship Dreadnought, the size of Rowl, down to the tiniest destroyer, energetic, no larger than Gwen's smallest finger. There were several spaces in the case that had recently been emptied. Those spots showed a lack of fine dust where the bases of the models had rested. The ships destroyed in the Auroran attack, perhaps? Opposite the replica's case, behind the desk, was a large section of wall that had been papered with a variety of maps, from large-scale renderings of the known world down to ancient copies of the schematics of Spire Albion. Gwen had seen similar maps in her father's study. They were continuously updated, hyper-accurate charts of both geography and etheric currents, the ones used by the fleet and kept in secret storage by ship captains, with orders to destroy them should the ship be in danger of being taken. All in all, Gwen thought, for a monarch who had claimed to be rendered obsolete by the tides of history, Lord Albion seemed to be following the game rather closely. This was no study. In every way that mattered, it was a throne room. Two men occupied the room. One of them was the Spireark, obviously, seated behind his desk, looking as affable and unthreatening as he had the first time she'd met him. The other was the outcast officer, Captain Grimm. He stood in the corner nearest the miniatures with one arm in a sling and his back against the wall. He was dressed in the very clothing he'd worn when his men had come charging down the tunnel, though perhaps his coat was stained with even more blood. Lord Albion rose, smiling, as they entered. Ah, the heroes of the truly desperate hour! Had that group managed to carry their explosives to their companions, Albion might have suffered a crippling and permanent loss in the form of our largest crystal battery. Please, be seated. Gwen and Bridget stepped into curtsies, which Bridget had not quite gotten the hang of. Benedict swept into a polished bow, and then each of them sat down in one of the five chairs in front of the Spireark's desk, with Rowl settling on Bridget's lap.
"Sire," Benedict said, "how may your guard serve you?"
"Well, you could start by leaving out the honorifics,"
Albion replied, "at least while we're in here."
"I know, I'm the Spireark, and you obviously do as well. That seems, to me, sufficient, and it will save time."
Benedict said, "Ah." But he frowned as he settled back in his chair. "In that case, how may your guard serve you?"
"By waiting a moment," Albion said. "I'm expecting two more."
Not half a minute later, the doorknob to the study rattled. It made a few fitful clicking sounds, and then a man's voice sighed audibly.
"Blast and curse the confounded things, Folly!"
The door opened, and a rather odd old man entered. He was dressed in a bottle-green suit that looked as if it had fit him properly at some point in the last few decades. It had an odd sheen on it, as if... Gwen arched an eyebrow. God in heaven, the man wasn't wearing a silk-lined suit. He was wearing a suit made entirely of ether silk, with what had to be multiple layers of the expensive material. A girl with the bearing of a servant or apprentice followed him into the room, her eyes on the floor. She was dressed in a collection of cast-off clothing worn in very odd ways, and her eyes were rather unsettling, one a grey-blue, the other a fiery green-gold. She carried a jar of what looked like common expended lumen crystals, which she held as one might an infant. The other hand was stretched out behind her, dragging a pair of small children's wagons in a little train. Both had been filled to overflowing with all manner of apparently random articles.
"Addison!" the old man cried, hurrying in. He peered owlishly at Grimm, standing in the corner. "Ah!" he said. "Exactly who I was looking for! I need this man!"
Lord Albion lifted an eyebrow.
"Yes," he said, drawing the word out a bit. "That's why he's here."
"That was
"'Deucedly clever of you, Addison,' the old man said. "'However did you manage it?'
"'You told me about him yesterday, Master Ferris,' said the Spyrarch in a patient voice, "'and advised me to secure his services.'
The old man's head rocked back.
"'Really? Are you quite sure?'
"'Entirely,' Albion said. "'There were only so many experienced independent captains with damaged ships willing to take you to landing to choose from.'
"'Extraordinary,'
Ferris muttered.
"'And you're sure he's the proper one?'
"'I am. Master Ferris, this is Captain Grimm. Captain, I believe you have met Master Ferris.'
"'I have indeed,'
the outcast replied.
"'Ha!' Ferris said. "'Aha, Captain! I told you, did I not, that you and I would meet today.'
"'As I recall it, you did.'
"'I thought as much,' Ferris said, nodding.
"'Very well, then. Shall we get going?'
Albion cleared his throat.
"'Master Ferris, if you please, could you possibly share the reason you need the good captain's vessel?'
"'To find the enemy, of course,' Ferris said. "'There's mischief afoot.'
"'Ah,' Albion said. He did not say it with much enthusiasm.' "'Is there anything more specific you can tell me?'
Ferris considered that.
"'Doorknobs are extremely complex technology.'
Albion nearly failed to suppress a sigh.
"'Do you think landing is in danger?'
"'Of course it is. We all are.'
"'It's not impossible,' Grimm said quietly. "'Except for morning, Habel Landing is the largest center of commerce in the Spire.' If the Aurorans have more explosives and use them on the docks, it would cause chaos. I'm not an economist, but a very significant portion of Spire Albion's inter-Habel trade passes through landing at some point.
75%, the Spyrarch provided.
God in heaven, Grimm said. Is it that much?
Every Habel charges for passage through its portion of the transport spirals,
Albion said. Nodding.
Transport by barge or windlass is cheaper, faster, and safer. By bypassing some or all of the tariffs, a merchant can as much as double his profit margin.
And if the shipyard at landing were destroyed, how much harm would it do the Spire?
Incalculable, Albion said. Eventually the shipyard at landing would be rebuilt, but the economy would be crippled or paralyzed in the short term. And our capacity to support a war effort would certainly be greatly reduced until it was functioning again.
"'Excuse me, sire.'
"'That is, excuse me,' Gwen said,
trying to sound properly respectful while utterly ignoring the propriety of the Spyrarch's title. It felt clumsy and wrong, like trying to sing with a mouthful of breakfast.
"'I don't understand. If the Aurorans wanted to destroy the landing shipyards, why not just do it with their ships?'
"'Presumably,' Grimm said, "'because the only ships fast and quiet enough to slither in past our patrols are their destroyers. Their weapons are destructive, but relatively light. It would take them time to pound the landing yard to splinters, and the landing defense guns in our fleet would object. It takes armored capital ships to accomplish something like that. Their larger guns will destroy the target far more rapidly.' And their armor and heavy shrouds will enable them to stay until the job is done.
Bridget frowned. I thought the Aurorans who entered the Spire had been defeated and captured. Would that they had, Albion said quietly. The ships that strafed the morning shipyards managed to evade the fleet, but Captain Bayard got Valiant in close enough to the enemy formation to confirm the presence of an Auroran troop transport.
"'I don't know what that means,' Bridget said.
"'Auroran troop transports carry a full battalion of their marines,' Benedict said quietly, "'round 500 men.
"'How many have been accounted for?'
Gwen asked.
49, Albion replied. Those taken in the attack on Lancaster Vattery, and several men who evidently attempted to parasail into the vents and missed their target.
Their bodies were found on the surface.
Gwen imagined men, their parasails tangled and collapsed, screaming as they fell nearly 2 miles through the mist, faster and faster and faster. She tried not to shudder.
I see.
I'm not sure I do, Benedict said. What is our part in this to be? Albion spread his hands.
You three are, I'm afraid, a remainder, as it were.
Sire? Gwen said.
Oh, bother. I'm sorry. Excuse me?
Lord Albion rose and took a couple of the large maps down from the wall behind him, revealing a 2-scale rendering of the entire spire.
Spire Albion, he said. 10,000 feet high. 2 miles across.
There are 250 habels, of which 236 are occupied.
As many as 450 heavily armed enemy marines are in here with us, somewhere. Do you remember how many guardsmen are in active service, Miss Lancaster?
A little more than 3,000, she said.
Albion nodded.
Mr. Sorrelin, do you know how many marines serve in Home Fleet?
A full regiment, Benedict replied. He glanced at Bridget and added, 1,500, more or less.
Precisely, Albion said. 4,500 bodies to protect 236 potential targets.
He spread his hands. I've been forced to dispatch them all up and down the spire.
But why?
Bridget asked.
Wouldn't it be wiser to fight the Aurorans with all of them? I mean, it seems to me that 4,500 men could see to 500 foes.
We do not yet know where the Aurorans are, and our numerical advantage means nothing until we do,
Albion replied. More important, some enemies are far more dangerous than mere soldiers, however formidable.
Right now, rumors are spreading, and fear spreads with them. Fear kills. Before all else, order must be maintained, and that means reassuring the citizens of Albion that they are protected.
And you're sending us to protect Hebel Landing?
Gwen guessed.
In a way, Lord Albion said.
The Auroran fleet knew precisely from which angle to attack Morning's shipyards to minimize the effectiveness of defensive fire.
They sent their troops into the spire, and they evidently know its tunnels and vents well enough to remain hidden, at least so far. They knew exactly where to find the Lancaster Vattery, and their uniforms were all but identical to ours.
Gwen frowned, thinking.
No one of those things seems particularly important, but when you put them all together...
Lord Albion smiled at her, clearly waiting for her answer.
"There's a hidden hand in this,"
Gwen said.
"Someone who knows the spire,"
she blinked.
"Someone who lives here."
"Top marks,"
Lord Albion said.
"There is a traitor among us. Perhaps even within my guard."
Raoul looked up at Bridget and made a sound. Bridget translated.
"That is why you are sending kits to do a hunter's job."
Albion looked at Raoul and nodded.
"Precisely.
I need to send someone I can trust."
When this operation was being planned, none of the trainees had reported for duty. The enemy's operation pattern suggests intimate knowledge of the workings of the guard and fleet alike.
"What about me?" Benedict asked. Albion waved a vague hand.
"Oh, come now. It isn't you, Sorrelin."
Gwen thought that her cousin didn't know whether to look relieved or somewhat insulted, but he managed to nod at Lord Albion.
"So you're sending us?" Bridget asked. "To do what? I only ask because it seems that it will be easier to follow your orders if we have actually heard them."
Lord Albion's eyes crinkled at the corners.
"I've dispatched a number of small teams of recruits on various errands to various Habels. I'm sending you to Habel Landing with Master Ferris so that you may assist him in his inquisition."
"Ah,"
Gwen said, nodding. If I may be so bold, what are you to be looking for, Master Ferris?
You apparently are, Master Ferris said, and I'm all but certain I'll know it when I see it.
Albion did smile that time.
Landing has more residents and more people constantly coming and going than any other habitable in the Spire. It's a hotbed for information and black market trade. If there is anything to be learned about our guests or of a viper in our midst, it will be learned there.
Ah,
Ferris said in a more subdued voice.
Yes, precisely. I will also be gathering information.
Albion pointed a finger at Benedict. Your sole concern during this operation is the physical well-being of Master Ferris. He is of critical importance to the security of Spire Albion. You are to stay with him at all times. You are to protect him. Whatever happens, he must return safe. Do you understand?
Benedict nodded soberly.
I do.
Albion's gaze moved on to Bridget. I'm sending you and Mr. Rowell because if there's trouble afoot in Landing, the local cats will know it. They rarely have cooperative dealings with any human, but I believe they may make an exception in your case. You are to serve as Master Ferris's liaisons with the local cats.
I can do that, Bridget said. What about me?
Gwen asked. She was sure that she had kept her impatience out of her voice, but Lord Albion's eyes smiled again.
Miss Lancaster, having taken note of your talents and your obvious, determination to stay your course, regardless of how ill-conceived it may be, I'm sending you along to be a smoother.
A what?
Your duty is to smooth the way for Master Ferris's Inquisition. The Inquisition must keep moving forward. You are to avoid, overcome, or knock down any obstructions that may block his path.
Gwen found herself frowning.
I'm not sure I understand how to do that.
I'm not sure you understand how to do anything else, Benedict quipped.
Gwen fetched him a quick kick in the ankle with the side of her foot. Captain Grimm, Albion continued as if he hadn't noticed, will be transporting you down to Landing, and we'll be ready to lend you his support and that of his crew, should you have need of them.
He looked back and forth between them.
Do you understand your objectives? Do you have any questions?
Bridget said tentatively. What is it we're doing, exactly?
She hurried to add. Oh, I understand that each of us has a responsibility to help Master Ferris, but we still don't know what we're to be helping him with.
The Spyrarch regarded her gravely.
Do you know what the phrase operational security means, Miss Targwin?
No.
It means that not everyone has all the information, he said. That way, if you are spied upon or captured and interrogated by the enemy, it will not benefit them. You cannot accidentally let slip secrets you have not been told. You cannot be tortured and forced to reveal information that you do not possess.
Bridget's eyes opened very wide.
My goodness.
I leave it to Master Ferris to decide how much each of you must know to perform your duty adequately,
the Spyrarch said.
He will inform you at his own discretion.
Until such time as he does so, you have your duties.
Is that clear?
It seems simple enough, Bridget said.
The most difficult things often are,
said Lord Albion.
Pack for the trip and do it swiftly.
You leave within the hour.
Chapter 21 Spire Albion, Fleet Shipyards. Bridget held Rowell in her cradled arms as they walked up the spiral ramp leading from Habel Morning to the shipyards on the Spire's rooftop, and tried to keep her breathing steady.
Honestly,
Rowell said.
What are you so concerned with, little mouse?
I've never, Bridget said. I've never really been outside.
There are many things you have never done,
Rowell responded.
To be frightened of them is of no use to you.
Bridget glanced over her shoulder, where Benedict was walking with Master Ferris, never more than a couple of strides away from the old man. He'd shouldered his own pack, and an enormous duffel, apparently meant for Master Ferris and his